My name is Donna Cease, and I'm the Spiritual Programs Coordinator for Kadampa Center. And we have a really wonderful visiting teacher here this week, Karuna Caton. He's really quite wonderful, very gentle and very articulate also. Really good at explaining Buddhism to Western minds. He's a longtime student of Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Well, I can't show you them, but they're the founders of our mother organization, FPMT. He spent about 13 years working at Kopan Monastery in Kathmandu. Kopan Monastery was founded by Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and he was teaching secular studies to the monks and also helping prepare Buddhist studies for foreign visitors. And he co-founded and was at one time the director of the FPMT Center in Kathmandu. Then he came back to the West. He's been a clinical psychologist for about 24 years. And he also directs a counseling group. And all of his work, of course, incorporates the wonderful, mind teachings of Buddhism for secular uses. So, we'll be enjoying his wisdom tonight. Just a word before he arrives about a couple of things. If you're used to coming here when Geshe-la comes, well, of course, when any teacher enters the room, we stand out of respect for the teachings that they hold. And then those who choose to will prostrate, and again, that's out of respect for the teachings that they hold. And with Geshe Gelug, because he's very humble, asks that we prostrate with him, but we will wait until Karuna's seated if we're going to prostrate. And if you're not comfortable prostrating, that's fine. I also just want to say a couple words about how we are able to afford having Karuna here. We have long had a tradition at Kadampa Center of never charging money for the Dharma, because we don't want money to be an obstacle for anybody to hear these teachings, because they're so beneficial. But we do have expenses to bring someone in, and he flew in here from California. We are sharing some of that cost with another center, but we still have cost to bring him in and house him and feed him while he's here. So if you are moved by anything you hear tonight or at any time during his teachings here, we would be very appreciative of any heartfelt contributions you would choose to make. There's a donation box right outside the door, and you can also go to our website online and go to the Karuna Caton page, and there's a little form there if you wanted to donate online. Thank you so much. He should be here any minute.
So I use the PowerPoint a lot because I think it keeps people awake. It keeps me, also reminds me what I'm supposed to teach, though.
Okay, we'll start with our Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer. If you take your gold prayer book and turn to page 98. And I think we'll do this one in English tonight. Three times. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Now flip over to the page before, and we will do the short mandala offering. This is a prayer that we make an offering in order to receive the teachings. So we'll chant this one in Tibetan.
Saji Puki Drawing Probably
Again, thank you for coming. Good to see you. I was here 4 years ago. So, I don't know if some people I recognize, of course. So I'm here from today, I think, through Sunday. So tonight, how it's explained to me is tonight is a little bit more of a Buddhist group. I'm more regular students. Is that right? Anyone who's never been here before? Oh, good. Tomorrow night we have another talk for parenting with compassion, I think, right? And then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we'll go into the weekend workshop on The Misleading Mind, which is a book I wrote 4 years ago. And we have something happening Sunday morning.
Sunday morning is our regular Sunday Dharma.
Right. So I think because there's some new people here that don't know me, I'll just give a little introduction. I hope not the wrong thing comes up there. Like some video game or something. So nothing's coming out. Okay. It will come up some point. How good are you with...
Should work.
It should. It's just...
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's the right... So I think I know what it is.
It's just your
video. We'll just put it on. I think if you just hit the... Here, go ahead.
Go ahead. What were you going to do?
I was going to do that.
Oh, it's not... Wait. Mm-mm.
It flashed.
It did. He like knows about it, but it.
Go ahead. You take it. Okay. So while he deals with it, this always happens, I think. Okay. So a little introduction about myself. Also, student like you. What happened is in 1975, I'll repeat this again, I'm going to do The Misleading Mind, so I'll try and keep it short right now. 1975, I went to Nepal on a year abroad program and I fell in love with Nepal and stayed 12 years. It was a year in Nepal. Time goes slower there. I won't give the whole interesting biography, but essentially, as a student, I had to do a program. I was originally going to do something in Hinduism. So this is back, 75 is a while ago, and I had been studying yoga and teaching yoga and was involved in that spiritual discipline because there wasn't much Buddhism those days that I knew. You know, I worked on this for hours. I got stuck in Chicago last night. And I thought that's good because then it gives me more time to prepare something, you know, visual. So I did do that. Anyway, so in 1975 to 1988, I had a really, really great fortune to live and work and study at Kopan Monastery, which is the founding monastery where all these different centers have started, Kadampa Center being, of course, one of them. My root teacher, Lama Yeshe, was also Lama Zopa Rinpoche's main teacher, and Lama Yeshe passed away in 1984. Yeah, so I had the great fortune of being, you know, working with him, and I will share many different stories with him over time, because it's really his, anything that I have useful to say, and I'm not just saying this out of false, hey, wait, that's the wrong slide.
You forgot the green term mantras.
Yeah, which one? Is that what you did?
Do you want the lights down?
Yeah.
Yeah. I got so many slides, you know what? I'm going to probably only cover one of them. maybe three. Okay, sorry guys and gals. Okay. Well, that's not big enough. Do you know how to make it bigger, anybody? The left one, that one? Oh. Somebody want to do this while I talk? David? I usually don't. Yeah, anyway. That's the slide I want to start on.
All right, this is PowerPoint.
Okay, so we'll get into it. We'll get into this. Sorry for it's a little distracting. So my main teacher is Lama Yeshe, and I want to share his... there you go, thank you. Share him with you. Anything that you might get from me is from him, or Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's also my root teacher. So this is a little tricky talk tonight. Oh, by the way, in 1988, sorry, I should have to finish the story. 1988, upon Lama Zopa Rinpoche's suggestion, myself, my wife, and two of our three kids were born. We moved back from Nepal to here, to the States. I'm in California. And didn't know what to do. What do you do with 12 years of working with Tibetan Buddhist monastery? How do you translate that into work here? And so Rinpoche said, why don't you do psychology? So that's what I did. And I trained in California, got my master's in clinical psychology, which, if you know, those of you know who know Buddhist studies, you know, actually that's the best choice. For me it's the best choice. You know, really, in terms of Buddhist studies, it's very interesting because what Buddha himself taught is usually collected or categorized into three groups. All his teachings can fall into one of these three groups. And those three groups, it's so fascinating. Even His Holiness said a few years ago, if you look closely at the three groups, clearly two of them are psychology. It's pretty amazing. So when people ask you, is Buddhism a religion or not? You know, people maybe don't know, they wonder. I say people have made it a religion, but if you go to the source, which I like to do and I encourage you to do, go to the sources, it's not about religion. It's not much about faith. You know, there's a little bit about faith, but it's not a faith-based, system of thinking. It's not at all. It's actually quite, I guess you could say scientific. It's logical, right? And so psychology was a natural area. So I went to get my degree, and I can't tell you, and this is another story that you got to protect me from going on tangents, because I get very excited about stories. But if you can imagine spending that amount of time in Nepal, I did get a chance to study while I was working, but mostly I was working for Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and sneaking off to study, sneaking off to try and do retreat. Lama Yeshe was very wrathful with me, and if I can share that with you. In this system, Tibetan Buddhist system, the foundation, if you want to get happy, if you want to be happy, then you attain, in order to be happy, one has to have a healthy mind. They're equated as synonymous in Buddhist thinking. To have a healthy mind, you have to learn to control the mind. To control the mind, you have to know the mind. Right, okay. So you have to know psychology. You have to study what is the nature of mind. You have to study what's happening. Just like you would do if you were going to do psychotherapy, you have to know what the model is that you're going to be therapizing people with, correct? Okay. So in this model, it's important to study. And it's important to contemplate. And it's important to meditate. Meditate. So what does meditation mean? Donna, what does it mean?
It means being mindful when you're setting up the office.
Thank you. Again, we'll cover some of this later in a couple of days, but the Tibetan word for meditation, the Tibetan word for meditation, if you translate it, it's very interesting what it means. Anybody know? I'm sure someone. Yeah? Denise? Yeah. Isn't that amazing? So when you meet your friends and people and they say, yeah, I meditate, and you ask them, what do you mean? And they don't say, I'm becoming familiar. Of course, familiar with what? Yeah, with your mind. You can be familiar with your mind and then the way the world functions, but primarily your mind. So people say, I meditate. What do they mean usually? Stress reduction. Mindfulness, even. Don't get me started on mindfulness. I have to be careful. Mindfulness is a good thing. Mindfulness is a good thing, but it's not what we mean by meditation if you want to speak strictly. And I'm, even though I function in this culture and I think I'm kind of I am a Westerner and I'm not extremely into faith type things, I'm pretty traditional. Because I keep going to the source and studying it, and then you tear it apart, you analyze it, and then you come. So becoming familiar, why mindfulness and these kinds of things are not the solution is because they don't in and of themselves lead to what we're talking about as being mentally healthy. Okay? The goal in Buddhist thought, the goal in Buddhist practice is to become happy. And the way to become happy is to be mentally healthy. Simple. Okay? And then the way to become mental... Now, you could take other traditions and they'll have a different answer to that. They say, the way to be happy is... Any system of thought has an idea how to be happy. That just doesn't necessarily fit what's thought in this system. Okay? Actually, modern psychology might be the closest. Because they will say something like, not having mental disorders. I know what they say. I do know what they say. But they don't know what they say. Sorry. Any therapists here? Mm-hmm. Any psychologists? Or social workers? Okay, well, you guys are already converted. But yeah. So we can talk about that later. Huh? No one wants to be labeled. And it's a tangent. But I'll say for my Buddhist friends, even Buddhists do that. They label. Because we're a pathology-driven culture. That's how we make sense of the world. It's unfortunate. And in Buddhist psychology, we have psychopathology. We have pathology. And what happens is people, if we're not careful, we can begin pathologizing our friends and other people and ourselves using Buddhist psychopathology. Not a lot different than pathologizing ourselves with Western modern psychology. I'm codependent, I'm an alcoholic, I'm depressed. What's now? Bipolar is very popular, right? I'm ADHD. I have worked with these a lot with people who... Now, labels are okay if you understand them as labels. And the same people, then we say, what do we say? In Buddhist, what's Buddhist psychopathology? I have a lot of afflictions. I have anger. I have so much attachment. Can I have a beer tonight? Oh, no, a beer, it's really, that's really negative. You shouldn't drink beer. Because you might be an alcoholic. So there's all these prescriptions. We have to be careful as Buddhists too. It's okay to have those prescriptions if you know why, right? But just having a label, we've got to be careful. That's how we're raised. Not all of us. Maybe not in North Carolina. Right? Okay, so what I was asked to teach tonight, before I forget, we don't have much time, do we?
No.
I got to cover all this stuff, okay. So what was, I understand that Geshe-la, a very, very, very kind Geshe-la, is one of my, I have really so much respect for him. People here, I think, do take classes with him, right? Yeah. You're very lucky to have him. So I'm just the substitute teacher tonight for him. I'm very happy to do this, but I'm a student like you guys. What I was talking about with Geshe-la, I think, has been going through a particular prayer that's in one of our traditional texts in terms of Lam Rim prayer, correct? Yeah. And we don't have to talk about it, but I think that Donna was suggesting, well, why not talk about sort of the area of the text that he's in terms of how to it applies to everyday life. That's kind of what you're asking. And so I prepared all these slides that have nothing to do with that. Okay? That's not true. What that's called, so when we talk about, again, another important point, I'm going to say to you that this is very important or the most important thing. I do that a lot. I shouldn't repeat. I don't mean to lie. It's just I think of it and I think, oh, that's really important. So in Buddhist psychology, in Buddhist thought, in Buddhist system, the idea is that in our tradition, in this Mahayana tradition, is to get control of the mind in order to attain full awakening. Okay, I'll just throw it right out there. I use the word awakening, I don't use the word enlightenment very often. The fully awakened being or fully awakened mind is the most healthy mind. It is the most healthy, permanent, eternal, I should say eternally healthy mind. Okay? We can talk about that more. It's a short talk tonight, so I have to talk in generality sometimes. You see, what's different about this approach is that if you and I want to become awakened, okay? Now, if we want to become awakened means, because there might be some new people, so awaken here, when I use the word awakened or enlightened, it has to be understood as a very tangible, achievable goal. You know, when I was, before I became Buddhist, and I was interested in the Hindu tradition, you know, and they talk a lot about, you know, different deities and different realms to attain. It always seems so, I mean, maybe it was just me. Don't, I'm not generalizing about that tradition. But for me, it always seemed like, wow, it's way up there. Like in the sky. With these heavens. Maybe even in the Judeo-Christian tradition, maybe the heavens seem so far away. Like, it doesn't seem like something you really attain. I mean, you might attain later. That's not the case in this tradition. Okay? I want to really encourage people. And part of the message tonight is that if you're not getting anywhere in your practice, then you need to re-examine your practice. If your mind is not getting better, if your mind's not getting happier, if your mind's not getting clearer, if your mind's not getting more control, not every day, don't worry about that. Probably not even every week. For more advanced, long-time students, maybe every month. Early on, maybe check it after a year. That's unusual, isn't it? You go to a therapist and he says, or she says, yeah, you'll be okay, you'll be better in a year. You know, you'll walk out. Unless you're really something severe, you know. Right? We're pretty much an instant gratification mentality. This is not instant gratification, but it is eternal gratification. Okay? You don't slip back. You know, when you go to, well, my clients anyway, you know, they slip back. So I help them with one thing, and then, you know, 6 months, a year later, hey, you know, can I come in again? They slip back. Okay? In this tradition, you have to become your own therapist, which people don't like hearing. They want someone else to fix it. They don't want to work. I mean, generally we don't want to work because we're used to like turning on the television, the microwave. You know, your car, you start from your smartphone. Now your car, you don't even have to drive it anymore. Well, my friend has one of those Teslas that self-drives. No, this is what's happening, right? And so it's not all... The bad part of that is we become conditioned to thinking that we approach spiritual path, or let's put it different. We approach, you know, the mind and making the mind healthy, and we expect the same thing. And it's really painful, a lot of suffering, a lot of sadness, a lot of struggle when we find we can't do it that way. We almost don't know, like, what to do. Like, something's wrong. Does that make sense? People know what I mean? Yeah. 40 years. Can you believe it? 40 years. I'm not sure that's encouraging you or discouraging you. But 40 years. I mean, I never thought 40 years ago that I would I'd only be here. I thought 40 years ago I was going to be enlightened in 3 years. I thought for sure. You know, at some point it will be 3 years, right? For all of us. Some point, 3 years from that point, you will be enlightened. That's pretty awesome. And different for everybody. You know, some people might be right there now. Okay, I can't, you know, we can't judge. So I'm still in the first... So the foundation, yeah, without a foundation, it doesn't work. So the purpose of this path is to become awakened. What does awakened mean? Just so we have some working definition. Awakened in this case means that your emotional disorders, your mental disorders, your emotional afflictions no longer arise. The reason they call it awakened, I hope to get to that point. If not, remind me to explain it at the end. There's a reason it's called awakening. Well, I'll tell you right now. The reason it's called awakening is because if we awaken, then what does that mean we are right now? Asleep. So I think asleep is not exactly the right, you know, it does mean that. I think a better way is that we awaken from the way we see ourselves and the world. The way we see ourselves and the way we see the world is incorrect. And when that begins to dissipate through practice, mental practice, mental training, then this whole thing happens. And you go, wow. I mean, it must be like that. Wow. That whole time you thought it was real wasn't real. And what appears in its place is a whole different way of seeing things. So it doesn't mean that we all disappear. Let's get that clear. You know, like there's some parallel universe. What is parallel, I guess? Some other universe that, oh, I awaken and now, you know, none of my friends are here. I mean, you know, no, it's not like that. It's everything seen differently. And it's seen as it truly is. Can you imagine that what we're seeing now is not how it is? I think that's phenomenal. Okay, so how do we get there? So it's not like when I was younger, I was telling you about that other tradition. It's not like, okay, you know, confused or unenlightened and then enlightened. It's not going to happen like that. I don't care what all the stories say, all the Zen stories or being slapped with a sandal and, you know, there might be a moment when you get hit with the sandal and then all of a sudden you see reality. But you think you didn't prepare for that? You did prepare for that. Maybe for lifetimes. Okay. So does the light go on instantly or gradually? I have a question for you. What do people think?
Gradually.
We think instantly, don't we? It's gradual. Really? Because could you... let's see. Could you go out there and turn on the light? And the light will go on in the outdoors? If there's no light there, I mean. No. So you got to build the building, and you put the wiring in, you got to put the fixtures in, you got to, right? And then just turn on the, see, we're kind of stuck on that one moment the light goes on. That's wrong. That light went on out there, this light went on gradually. It took a lot of people, a lot of work. How long has this building been here?
About 20 years, I think.
And who built it? Lots of people. Yeah. So, and who invented like electricity and the light bulb and Edison and all those guys? You know what I mean? You just change your thinking. We think it goes on instantly. It doesn't. Even if we think when we switch it on is instant, we're wrong. It's just the way we see things. You know, for some people with deep perception, that turning on the light is like a very gradual process. Even for us, it's just kind of instant. Because their minds are so slowed down that they can see. Because let's say it's 1 second, okay? But there's microseconds, right? And we don't perceive the microseconds. And in some studies, anyone know how many microseconds? It's 1,000. There's 1,000 microseconds in a second. Are those perceivable? In theory, are they perceivable?
Yes.
How many say yes? They are, definitely. Why don't we see them?
Too fast.
Too fast for us. Why? Is it the light's too fast or that we're too slow?
We're too slow.
Okay, so even for that, it's not even instant, it's gradual. I guess I'll go to the next slide. Getting bored with that one. Okay, so, well, let's see what's next. I don't even remember. Okay, so the main aim is development of the awakening mind. For what we call this, typically referred to as, in the, so you'll hear it referred to as bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word. And it means awakening mind. Bodhi is awakened. Chitta is mind. And it's good for as we study this. This is a big topic for us. It's a very popular topic in Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist thought. And it's often referred to as the mind seeking enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. That's not wrong. But I think something's lost or it sounds a bit emotional. The bodhicitta, the awakening mind, is actually in us. Okay, it's potential. And let me put it this way. If you're familiar with meditation and, you know, watching your mind, you probably know that every instant, if you're like me, if you're not like me, you don't care because you're not like me. You're awakened. So every instant of our mind is engaged in satisfying ourself. Every instant. Every instant, I am being fulfilled, quote, fulfilled. Even when you're doing something for someone else. That's a bit harsh. Bodhicitta, so that's natural, right? We don't have to think about, I don't have to think about reaching for this and having some water, do I? You don't have to think about, you know, shifting your posture because your legs are getting, you know, stiff. You don't have to think about, you know, taking off your coat because it's going to warm. You just do it. You don't have to think about breathing. But who is your breathing for? Think about it. Your breathing is either for you or for someone else. There's no other choice. So who's it for?
You.
Yeah. So just as naturally as we do that, like right now, if you can just be honest and just be sensitive, who are you sitting here for right now? I mean, it's a rhetorical question. My point is, you're sitting here going, I'm sitting here for me. And if I don't like what I'm hearing, I'm going to leave. Or I like what I'm hearing, right? It's all about I. And we don't think about that. We don't want to contrive it. It just is natural, correct? Okay. So in bodhicitta, can you imagine this? In bodhicitta, it's exactly the opposite. It's everybody else. And everything else. Without thought. Okay, without any, it's not contrived. Now, as you're training in bodhicitta, it is contrived a little bit in the beginning. But the bodhicitta mind, so that's a mind in you and me. That mind is there. So we just need to get that thing going. And it's dormant. Because no one's told us about it. We don't even know it's there. And we've never developed it. We've never trained. You do have to develop it and train it. You can have insight into it. People do. But insight's not enough. Because what happens with insight? It's like when you go to therapy, you have insight. And then you've nothing much happens. I mean, I shouldn't say nothing much happens, but, you know, it doesn't really change your mind, generally speaking, right? Insight. Unfortunately, insight alone isn't enough. Insight is necessary. So after insight, it fades, right? When we talk about meditation, when we talk about mind training, it's about taking the insight and nurturing it, developing it. That's what mind training is. That's what meditation is. Okay? So if your meditation is not doing that, then, you know, you need to refocus it, recalibrate. And we always make mistakes, by the way. It's not like, you know, you could spend months on the wrong, you know, doing the wrong thing. That happens. Years. Okay. So this bodhicitta, this awakening mind, has relative quality to it and has an ultimate quality. Now, when we talk about, let's keep going, because I know I'm going to run out of time. Jeez Louise. Okay. So I want to stress that what I'm stressing is to develop this awakening mind. The development of the awakening mind is the end of all your problems. Okay, just like, okay, let's think about when you have to give a presentation. Okay, or talk. I think 85% of people have anxiety of public speaking. Is that right? Everyone looks at me. Who has anxiety of public speaking? Are you too anxious to say? Anyway, so anxiety of public speaking. So what happens, let's just imagine, okay, or think of any stressful encounter. Okay, what's your mind like? So the way the mind is almost possessed, right? Something possesses it. Okay, those minds cease to exist. Those emotions will cease to exist. And the bodhicitta mind, the more it awakens, the more those minds dissipate. But in the development of bodhicitta, unlike, there's other things you can develop. You can develop wisdom, you can develop compassion, you can develop lots of things. Meditation, single point concentration, many, 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 many things to develop. I would suggest developing bodhicitta, because if you develop bodhicitta, it'll develop all those other things. The other thing you need to do with it is understanding reality. So you've got to have bodhicitta with the understanding, the wisdom of understanding reality, which means sometimes referred to as emptiness. Okay? So now, why I suggest bodhicitta is the best thing is because every problem that you have, I have, this is where the whole thing is, tonight's talk. That's got to get to the point. The point is that unlike other practices, many other practices, you never hear this in other traditions. You won't hear it in the Hinayana or the southern tradition of Buddhism. You don't hear it either. That the problems themselves become the means for your enlightenment. Wow. That's pretty unheard of. Pretty phenomenal. So, this lady last night was my path to enlightenment, and I missed it. I got off the plane, and she said, in Chicago, and she said, if you hurry, I think you can make your flight. You know, anyone know Chicago? You guys almost know Chicago Airport. So I was at gate C21, and I had to go to gate C1. I'd never been there before, but I could figure it out, right? I'm running, because I didn't want to miss my connection. My plane was an hour late leaving San Francisco. And running. And then about two-thirds of the way down, I left my jacket on the plane. What would you do? Would you run back and get it and risk missing your flight? Or just forget about it? I did forget about it. Okay. Got around to it. And it was 5 minutes before the plane was leaving, and the gate was closed. So I missed my flight. So I ran all the way, went all the way back to the gate to get my jacket. And one of the United, you know, about a couple of United ladies there with, helpers. And so I wanted to get my jacket and I wanted to change. They had me on the 6 o'clock in the morning flight, which didn't work for me. So I went to the lady and I said, oh, I just want to, no, and she cut me off. She said, I'm helping people who haven't made their connections. Yeah, so I said, well, yeah, I missed my connection. She said, no, I'm helping people who are coming off the plane who have missed their connection. And I said, well, I just came off the plane and I missed. No, you came from over there. I'm helping the people coming from here. So I missed my opportunity. Because I started getting a little irritated. I missed my opportunity. That, in this presentation, which we're not going to get to the whole thing of, so I'll jump to the end, that, why is that an opportunity? Why?
Your emotions were strong and you could see it.
My emotions were strong, I could see it. But what's the opportunity there?
To have a good mind.
Not only have a good mind, thank you, Tom. Not only have a good mind, but that develops the good mind. I think when we become more controlled, see, this is the thing. It's not just Pollyannish. It's not just like sounds good. It actually works that way. It actually works that way. When our minds become more controlled, more awakening. When you meet that circumstances, it's a little bit like putting kerosene on a fire, and the fire being your own awakening mind. It actually enhances it. If you go into it right, you got to do the right thing. I mean, in my case, I lost, missed the opportunity. But as we get more mindful, there's a good word, right? Very common word, mindfulness. As we get more mindful, then we see the opportunity. In fact, first in the beginning is little opportunities. You go home and your favorite show didn't record like it was supposed to. And you get kind of irritated. And then you start remembering these things and you're trying to develop into a better person. That's good. And then you do that more and more. But then at a certain point, when the awakening mind gets involved, then those things they're not as contrived, they're automatic. It's almost like Rinpoche says, Lama Zopa Rinpoche says you look forward to them. I can't imagine. I think I used to think he's just like, what's that word I'm looking for? He's just like not tricking us, but just being too positive. But now I think I can see what he means. It actually I've been reading lately. If you want to attain the awakening mind, this is the bad news and the good news. If you want to attain the awakening mind, it's not attained anywhere else but in relationships. We could say, now we tend to think, no, Karuna's not, he's missing the whole point. The thing is to go to a cave or go to meditate, right? And we hear read about the great yogis and they're meditating. We're only paying attention to that part of their practice. We're only paying attention to that part of their development. Another part of their development we're not paying attention to is the part where they were with people and circumstance and in relationship. Okay? In relationship is when most of the awakening mind was developed for them. Okay? Oh, so many things to talk about. So in developing this, I was studying one text, many people know it, Advice from a Spiritual Friend. Have anybody heard of that? Anyone heard of it? Yeah. Yeah, I read that in Nepal or Asia, and I just got it out the other day and was looking at it. Very, very good. Ravi, have you read it? Yeah. Have you looked at it recently?
No.
It's just fascinating. It's just to relook at it. Because advice from a spiritual friend, what we're talking about is developing this awakening mind. I'm not going to say bodhicitta, awakening mind. Who doesn't want that? But then there's preliminaries. So a whole course can be given on each of these preliminaries. For the four preliminaries, they really want us to have some understanding of, is this precious human birth or precious human form, death and impermanence, karma, or cause and effect, and the suffering nature of our existence. And I'm not going to go through these, because I'd love to go through these, but I think I'll alienate too many people. Because people say, well, we already studied that. We say that 100 times. Geshe will always teach that. We know. I know. That was when I was a beginner. And I would challenge you. You know, but I won't. I'm going to be... I want to wear out my welcome. That's the expression, right?
Right.
But the point is, main thing here that I'd like to stress is that really reflect within yourself, and are you aware of the preciousness of this life? You know, you don't have to answer me. I'm just really reflect on the miracle of this life. And if you are, then right this second when I mention it, you feel it. Okay? And if not, that'd be good, but if not, then at least when you reflect on it, you can generate some experience, you know, some feeling. The preciousness of this life, well, that's also, I mean, it's like this, I must be like this miracle thing, this life. And I think that what happens is these four are related up here. So the miracle of this life is strengthened for us when we begin to really understand karma. Okay? Now, so karma is, all of these are tricky. The tricky part here is that intellectually and in theory we've studied these things, or even if we haven't studied, we can think about them and get some sense. So I want to stress for all of you who don't have this understanding that each one of these is experiential. Okay? Is that you develop an insight and then you can cultivate that insight and then it becomes experiential. And that's where we're, it's, I imagine, you know, for us, it becomes like just this precious human form. You know, if we really had it, then we feel extremely hypersensitive about wasting time. And what that means, waste time, too. I'm not going to go into it, but that's, you know, it's like, wow, we've got this. Now, why do I say it's related to this thing about karma? Karma, usually I like to talk about it as mental imprints. You know, mental imprint is a pretty good synonym for karma. It's not 100%. But karma is mainly a mental thing. And I'm sitting here looking at you. I see the color of the beautiful prayer flags, and you're sitting there in the movements. How am I experiencing you? How are you experiencing me? How are you hearing my sound? All that is dependent upon karma, meaning mental imprints. Okay? What we're experiencing now looks like you're there, I'm here, something physical, doesn't it? Do you know that to have any experience, we need to have a consciousness. We need to have some sense organ, of which we have 5, like eye, ear, nose, that sort of thing. And we need an object. Okay, now remember this. So let's just take eyesight for a second. When we look at something, so right now we're experiencing, most of what we're experiencing here is with our ears and our eyes, right? Okay. What of the experience, you can take the eyesight or your ears, or a sound, what of that is external to you? Can you tell me what percent is external to you of your experience? So you're experiencing colors and shapes or sounds. Okay, just take one of them. So let's say colors and shapes. Where are the colors and shapes? They're in the mind? What percent of them are in the mind? What percent is outside of you? The thing is, if it's 100, David, I think it was saying 100%. I'm not sure. Maybe, but it's a lot. Where do you experience it, though? Like, when I'm talking to you, David, right? I think you're out there sitting there on that chair with your light blue shirt. But if it's 100% in my mind, or let's say 95%, just so we can keep everyone, I don't even know, 95, maybe some people think not in my mind, maybe it's out there. So I know, I won't go into this too deep, we will do this later, but my point is that The way that I experience Dave and everybody else has to do with the fact that if it's mental, or a large part of mental, that has to do with mental imprints. There's imprints on my consciousness that are being activated. Imprints of blue and white and glasses and shape. Well, we didn't even say color and shape. It's what I was often referred to. But we don't see the world that way. I think David's over there, don't I? So karma has to do with understanding that dynamic. Okay? There's other things involved in that dynamic. But karma, one way to understand, let me put it differently, let me flip it around. One way to understand karma is to understand that dynamic, how much the mind is involved in experience. Whatever it's part of the experience is mental, that is a euphemism or a synonym for karma. So I don't like the word karma because it sounds like fate. It has to do a lot with mental imprinting. Okay? I'm imprinting right now a zillion times a second. All your colors and shapes and mics, all my entire experience, and even what I'm not really probably aware of, is being imprinted on my consciousness. That's karma, okay? Those are karmic imprints. Mental imprints. That also I'm projecting. I'm also experiencing, right? Okay? That's the ripening of other imprints from the past. So this precious human form is nothing more than a ripening of imprints. And my question to you guys is, do you know how long they're going to ripen for?
Eternity.
Eternity? Maybe they run out. People die, they run out. Okay? That's death and impermanence. They run out. We don't know when they're going to run out, and we don't know what's going to happen then when they do run out. Right? We don't know what imprints are going to ripen. So we have to develop appreciation for these four preliminaries because things are messed up. That's the problem. Okay? This ultimate... there's so much to talk about. So, because of this thing about karma is the most imprint is most important. When I experienced that lady last night, really what I was experiencing, I mean, I wasn't aware of it, but what was really happening was a ripening of imprints, wasn't it? I thought she was there doing this to me. Do you guys think like that? Things get done to you? Okay? Guess what? What do you think was really happening with that lady? I don't know. She had her own karmic imprints. In my universe, In my universe, I thought she was there being really nasty, rude, impatient. What do you want to say? Insensitive. That was the word. I don't know where she was. I don't even know if she was at all. I missed it. What I do know in hindsight was there was 95% or 100% ripening of imprints for me. If she was really that insensitive of a person, everyone would experience her insensitive, wouldn't they? So it's a subjective experience to large part. You know, how much is debate, you know, we debate on that, but just for the sake of tonight's conversation, that subjective part, I don't think anything's subjective. I think it's all objective. I think she was insensitive and hung up on her position and blah, 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 all this interpretation. You know what? It's all untrue. None of that is true. It's all made up in my mind. It's true for my mind, right? But it's not true in relative reality. In relative reality, what was happening was I created a story and a narrative about her based upon imprints that I thought were out there but were in here. Okay? When we have an appreciation for that dynamic, when we have an appreciation that we really can attain enlightenment, awakening, then we cannot attain awakening without problems. So we cannot attain awakening without problems. We can't attain the awakening mind without problems. So it's like, well, really?
You can't. Why do I say that? Anyone want to guess why I say that? Have I intimidated everyone? Why? Why can't we attain awakening without problems? Because we can't attain awakening without eliminating, we call it purifying, but eliminating all the afflictive emotions out of our brains and mind. There's no awakening without that. So can you just go to a cave and purify all your afflictions without them coming up? It's possible. But there's a quicker way. And that's do it right now. Okay? So in life. Because this talk was about how everyday life, right? Well, everyday life is messed up, I'm going to tell you. I mean, it's beautiful and it's wonderful and it's not totally messed up. But I can almost guarantee you that if the teachings are right, you're going to go from one problem, you're going to enter problems. Now, some people have big problems and some people have different little problems. That's true. You know, the problem in the hurricane is completely different than the problem right now. But there'll be another hurricane. Until we get rid of those imprints. The hurricane was nothing more than a series of imprints, by the way. Hate to tell you. You just all had them together. I didn't have those imprints, by the way, right? Or I would have been here with you. Okay? I didn't put those imprints on my consciousness somewhere back in the past. You did. Now, I might have next hurricane, I might be there. So the idea of thought transformation has to do with quickly attaining awakening. So when I met up with that woman last night, what did I do? I didn't really fight, but I got to be, you know, I wasn't as fun-loving as I would have hoped to be. So what does it mean? I mistook her for an object out there. And in my mistake as an object out there, I created more imprints. Dang. Yeah? I looked for her this morning when I went back. I looked for her when I went back to check in this morning. I thought, oh good, if I can meet up with her and maybe have a little more irritation, and this time I can fix it. And she wasn't there. She wasn't so kind to be there. Okay? This is what so those of you Buddhist students, you know, been here a while, that's what changes for us, is begin to look at these situations, difficulties, as really, now we always say, oh, it's my karma, I know it's just karma. I want you to go beyond that. I really, really hope you can go beyond just, oh, it's my karma. You know, oh, the traffic is my karma. Because it has to go from the point of view of motivation. You want to awaken. Okay? Wow, this gets really technical. The ultimate awakening mind, I don't know if this is, I'm going to run out of time. When we begin to understand how reality exists, so all of this is dependent. For those who really, really get fascinated, really it's getting to the more exciting, not the more, that's a judgment. You know, an exciting part of the philosophy, right, is the understanding of reality. It all comes down to that. It all comes down to understanding reality. Truth. Okay, ultimate truth. When we begin to look at ultimate reality and truth, then everything begins to make sense. Okay? We don't see things correctly. Nagarjuna says, viewing emptiness mistakenly is like grabbing a snake incorrectly. Brings ruin to those of little intelligence. So, I don't know, that's one of those traditional phrases about, you know, understand, if we don't understand reality correctly, it is dangerous. Because it sounds like nothingness. That's why I wasn't quick to agree with David whether everything is 100% mental. Is it? You know, what's the definition of reality? Anybody know? I won't test you because it's advanced. Anybody know? The definition of reality is very simple. I don't know if it's definition, but it's my definition. A good definition, not mine. But definition of reality is Definition of reality is seeing something the way it exists. That's all. Okay. Which, if, just based on this acceptance, if we don't see reality, that means we see everything as it doesn't exist. Ooh. What does that mean? Is that a problem? Mm-hmm. It is a problem if we want to become healthy. Because when we see things that they don't exist that way, then we react to and respond to them. Okay? You know? And then we're really, really prickly. Because you get on the plane and you don't get your seat that was assigned to you. Okay? I had an aisle seat, not a middle seat. Problems. Right? I'm not going to fly because I can't fly in a middle seat. You go out to your car and you know, everything. There's problems everywhere. You just go in your car tonight. Maybe you can't find your keys. Maybe it's dark. Maybe your battery's dead. Maybe a flat tire. Anything can happen. Anytime. Always does. It does anyway. But even small things is all because we don't see things correctly. You go to your, you get up in the morning, make a cup of tea, no milk. Happens, right? Who gets irritated with that? Karen? Where's Karen? David? Yeah. Right? It's so simple. Now we think, oh, this is small things. But no, compared to how our potential is, it's terrible that our mind moves all the time. It moves all the time. You know, when Donna was lighting these lamps, things back here. Anyone's mind move? Anybody move or not? Yeah. Did you move it or did it move you? It moved you, if you're like me. Okay? That's because we don't understand reality. Okay? Now, so this goes into all kind of emptiness stuff and all that kind of thing, but we're going to run out of time. Just quickly, so in understanding reality, so I want to transform everyday life. So how do I do that? What do I need to know? Okay, we need to know how we mess things up. That's what we need to know first. Because we tend to look at how to make things right. Oh, just see everything as empty. Empty what? What does that mean? Do you, okay, so what about this? Let me, this will work. What about, what if the way our identity is, like you say, you know, I'm Karuna, you say your name, I'm Donna, okay, I'm David, I'm Karen, like that, you think. When you say, if I call out your name, you're going to think it's me, right? Okay? That's your identity. Like when I say Donna, no one else goes, but something kind of moves in you, right? Yeah. So that thing that moved in you, and if, everyone, just think for a minute, just think if someone's calling your name, and you go, oh, he's calling me. That thing, that me. Okay, so that me, that I, that self-identity, whatever you want to call it, is with us 24/7, okay? And we're constantly reacting to it and responding to it. And just, this is the main point. That thing, that I, that self, that identity, that ego identity, doesn't exist that way. You spend your whole life catering to it. Me too. Spend your whole life catering to it. You build a house for it. You have kids for it. You buy pets for it. You go to school for it. You get a degree for it. You get a job for it. You go every day to work for it. And it doesn't exist that way. It's just this huge hoax. Okay, that is the purpose of this psychology. It's a hoax. It doesn't exist that way. How Karuna thinks he exists doesn't exist at all that way. I'm this, I'm that, I'm a psychologist, I'm a father, I'm a late traveler, I'm a missing a plane person, I'm sitting here teaching person. None of that guy even exists at all. Not that guy. Something exists, but not that guy. And yet, so this is kind of pretty tragic that we spend so much time fulfilling that guy, that girl, and he and she doesn't even exist. I mean, seriously, that's a big problem. I'm not saying that there's not something that exists. There's not a Denise that exists, a Jill Marie that exists. There's something there. But we don't know what it is. Most of us don't know. So go home and do your life, all for this thing, if you don't care. That is not even existing. And now that sounds pretty dire, but the good news is, I promise you, if you see how he or she does exist, because I didn't say it doesn't, I'm not saying you don't exist, that's nihilism, okay? No nihilism here. But it doesn't exist the way you think it does. Nor does this cup. Nor does this flower. I will tell you something. If we get to the point where we see how it does exist, very happy. Okay? Eternally happy. Okay, that's... And again, remember I said the light switch? It doesn't just happen. You gradually see it more and more and more, and that's the awake, and then the awakening mind begins to manifest. And then it becomes more and more predominant. It seems kind of, does anyone find this idea scary? Anybody find it scary? Hmm? Yeah. You're the only one. You and me. But wait a minute. Why don't you find it scary? That's okay. You don't.
What do you mean? What do you think?
If you, the idea that who you live your life for, who you think you are, doesn't exist at all, do you find that scary?
Yeah.
Huh?
It's weird.
It's weird. Yeah. Don't worry about it. If it's scary. That's okay. It might be, and in a way, at certain points, it should be scary because we think this is real. What I think of myself as Donna or Karuna, you're telling me that's not real? And I actually am saying it's not real. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, though. There is a Donna that exists. You're sitting there experiencing. But we hang on so much that I'm this and I'm that, that it could be scary all of a sudden to be taken away. You know, if you realize, like let's say your mother, and your identity is all around your kids and being a mother. And then you hear someone like me talking about, well, that's not really who you are. Okay? I mean, you are a relative mother. But that's not how we see. So here's the deal. Okay, I didn't make this clear. I think it says in this slide. Here's the deal. We have to understand that what the problem is I'm a student, I'm a son, I'm a teacher, I'm a wife, I'm a husband. Whatever you are, even right now, whatever you are, the reason you're not that, the reason you're not that in the way you think you are, the reason you're not that is because we say it is, this takes a lot of time. You have to go home and meditate on this. You have to get familiar with this. Familiar, remember? That's the meaning of meditation. You have to become familiar with how you think you see yourself. And how you see yourself and me is as something that's independently existing on its own. And this is a term, but that is your, when you get quiet and you really, like if I say something rude to you or I upset you, you'll feel that I really strongly, right? That I, how you see it and how we see it every moment is, we have the, it's a innate experience of it as existing from its own side, independently, on its own. And you might, people study, say, oh, I know it's not. I'm not talking about your intellect. I really want you to go to your instinctual. Right now, you're sitting there. Who's sitting there? How many people are sitting in their seats right now? You should all raise your hands. Okay, that eye. That one that says, I'm sitting here. You are seeing it, yourself, as existing independently. Okay? Or another way of saying, you're seeing it as existing on its own. Solidly. Not changing. All that's false. There's someone sitting there, but not the one, not how we are. That is the problem. We have to become familiar with the object, we call it the object of refutation, technical terms. But I want to keep it really real and kind of, more personal. When you walk to your car tonight, you're going to feel, I'm walking to my car, right? Do you know the feeling? I'm walking to my car. We have it every instant, even when we're asleep. And that eye is the thing we're trying to refute. And what we say, that eye, if you analyze it, you'll go, oh, I just want you to, like, if I'm walking with you and I stop you and I say, please describe that eye quickly. You'll say, okay, my identity, the one that was walking in the car or the one sitting here, first of all, it seems solid, seems concrete, seems real, doesn't seem to change, seems permanent, and seems independent. So that you have to become familiar with. When you're doing the dishes, just take a moment, go, how am I who do I believe I am? Not intellectually, the natural one, the wrong one. Right now I'm washing the dishes. Oh, become familiar that the person you think you are, this washing the dishes, is permanent, existing from its own side, not changing moment to moment, and is independent. Really someone there. Okay, now there's a lot of... So that's the thing. I mean, we could go into the right way of seeing it, but it's not useful until you really grasp clearly what the wrong way of seeing it is. And, just to become more confusing, so that's the sense of identity, how we hold ourselves. And there's only two things you have to worry about that you see wrongly, or we see wrongly. One is me, my identity. What's the other one? Everything else. So the subject and all objects. But objects, you can just, they're all seen the same. Just like that. So this cup, those flags, the ceiling, my voice, you're also seen that way. You're seeing them as existing independently, on their own, solid, not changing when they are changing, independently when they're not, they're dependent. Can something be independent and dependent at the same time? They're mutually exclusive. Something cannot be independent and dependent at the same time. It's like when people say, I really love you, but I'm angry with you. I'm so angry, I could kill you. But I love you. Can't do that. Sorry, I don't know where that came from. Independent. Is this too heady? So when you're upset, you see, the only way I could get upset with that lady was I had to see her as existing independently, solidly, concretely, unchanging. And at the same time, I'm having an experience of myself, solid, karuna, unchanging, permanent, independent. She's rude to me, right? Right? She's rude to me. That's why in thought transformation, which is what we're talking this topic tonight, is how would you like to turn that around? You use it, see, you have to have some study behind you, but all of a sudden, I had a great experience. I was sad because I didn't do it right, but later through the evening, I thought, wow, I could really see that strong sense of independence. I come up when I was with her, later, when I reflected on it. I could see, I saw her as independent. How great. At least they didn't have exactly the same perpetuation of that cycle of imprinting. Because at least later I caught it, right? Now when we get better and better, the idea is you catch it, you go through life experiencing, you know, doing it right then in situation. That's what it means to be a spiritual practitioner. Okay? Spiritual practitioner has nothing to do with meditating, yoga, astrology, whatever. It has to do, a spiritual practitioner means actualizing your human potential as in that precious human life. So right now, if I'm a good practitioner, I'm taking everything you're giving me, and it's teaching me all about my wrong view, how I'm seeing things incorrectly, myself and you. And I go, great, thanks. And then we get better. Now, it's easy to do when they're neutral situations. I say neutral because not good. It's harder to do when they're good situations than when they're bad situations. Because good situations, you get too excited. I mean, you're getting excited. So you also see things. There's a little bit of an explosion of self-existence. So that's why it's all suffering. Don't you hate that word? Okay, when I say suffering, it means it's all wrong. But the neutral situation is kind of the easiest probably to start. But when we get good, then, and you know, the practitioner's developing and training the mind has, his or her focus doesn't change. You develop concentration in the session and you have concentration when you leave the session. Now it's harder when you're out in the world leaving the session. How many people do some meditation? Is it easier when you're on your cushion or when you're out at work? Okay, so here's the trick. When you go to work, when you're not on the cushion, you begin to think, because generally what we're doing is we're just lost in the day. But when you leave your cushion, just say, bring it on. Anything, just, because usually what we'll do is if we get into a difficult, stressful situation and we'll, you know, have our cushion during a minute and we kind of block. Okay, don't lose it. Stay calm. Right? This is different. This is saying, no, come on. I'm not going to protect myself. We're going to another level. Now, in the Hinayana tradition, it's about protecting yourself, honestly. You know, which is necessary. If you're an alcoholic and you're trying to stop, don't go into a bar. Right? Protect yourself. So I'm not putting down those other approaches. I'm just talking about this approach. If you want to do it quickly, you invite it on. And something very interesting happens too. It's not just, you know, shift of perception. We do experience more and more kind of bliss, if I can use that word. Or pleasure. Pleasure is not the right word because it's not that pleasure. It's like your mind gets clearer. Okay? Your qualities develop. Can you imagine, it's 8:30, 3. How many slides? I told you I wouldn't get through. Did you know that we have 51 secondary minds? Okay? And I'll stop in a second, so don't worry. We have 51 secondary minds, and so we talk about six root afflictions, six root mental disorders, and we talk about the 20 secondary mental disorders, and those things are what's functioning almost all the time in us. It's kind of sad. Did you know also in that 51, there's 11 virtuous minds, wholesome minds. Those 11 minds start to awaken. Because they can't, because they're sort of obscured by these anger and attachment and running around and just being vague and, you know. But as you, so you gotta, so bring those guys, those bad guys up. Because, and then you begin to see with, that they're just, and we can talk about it later, I ran out of time, but you begin to see that, you know, as you see that you're seeing them incorrectly, you see them correctly. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the path is first to see how you're seeing correctly. That has a very powerful effect on the mind. And that opens up the mind. Slowly you see things correctly. Okay? As dependent arise, dependent, interdependent, things like that. Then also that allows those 11 virtuous minds and others to start functioning. Compassion. Okay? Non-ignorance. Non-hatred. I can't remember all 11. But you know, isn't that amazing? So when we meet certain people, those minds are functioning. You just get that feeling from them. That's because the other ones are not. They're not dominant. And that happens for all of us, right? That's what we're doing. Can you imagine? So then eventually we start living as with a mind of compassion as opposed to the mind of irritation. We start living with a mind of courage and heroism as opposed to the mind of victimhood. I didn't get to my best slide here, which is about blame. Okay? This, when we know who to blame for our problems, everything shifts. Okay? Okay, the blame for my problems is United Airlines, right? No. So then understand the blame is to this self-cherishing way of me, me, me. Okay, that's all. No, wait, I'm going to show you one last slide. My favorite slide. Okay. This is Geshe-la saying, we see things that are not there, and we do not see things that are there. That's the problem. So I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not really sorry for not going through all the slides, but that just happens. It's not the slides, right? It's our relationship, a conversation, although it's one way, sorry. But if you want to ask or discuss something, I'm very happy to do that. Robbie, you don't have anything you want to discuss with me?
No, I think some people are familiar with what you're talking about because we've been talking about mind and mental factors this week.
Oh, really? Oh, good.
Yeah, some overlap.
Oh, good. Was that bad or good?
Good.
Okay. I know. Who's teaching it? Oh, good. So, do you know the 11 virtuous minds?
I can't rattle.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, okay.
Shame and embarrassment are synonyms for those, two of them.
Yeah. You know, those are actually interesting because people don't like that word shame. I'm sure that's why you brought them up. But when you explain them, they make sense in that context. Wait, there was another. Anyway, shame, I think. One word I heard for shame was conscientiousness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And embarrassment would be, well, embarrassment is kind of social protocol, you know, isn't it?
Not offending others.
Not offending others, yeah. But being aware of offending others. I mean, it's the awareness of the offending of, yeah, anyway.
So you use the word innate.
Innate. Yeah.
Innate experience of existing from its own side.
Yeah.
So if it's innate, then using that innate, how is it changeable?
Well, the doesn't mean it's self-existent. But it does. Innate, sometimes is used with innate meaning self-existent, right? That's why you're asking.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. The English definition of it is that it's...
Right.
That's
all. So why I use that word, there's the other words maybe better to use, but why I use that is that there's two processes of ignorance, of misunderstanding reality. One process is learned. Like we learn in this life about things that are wrong. Like, well, I'll just be honest about it. Like God. You know, depending on how people define it. I mean, it could be a correct definition. But we learn philosophies that are incorrect or explanations like about soul. Again, soul could be right, but generally how we're taught about soul, it's an incorrect, learned ignorance or misunderstanding. The innate one, maybe I should use inborn, inbred, but we're born with it. And we've had it since beginningless time. Okay? But I don't mean innate in that sense of inherent. Or self-existent. It's not. There's nothing self-existent. There's nothing exist. What that mean? There's nothing exists from its own side, independently.
Thanks.
Yeah. Is there another word for that innate one that people know? Yeah. I'm glad you asked because I think that's what it means. Anything else? Come on. You want to go to bed? You want to go home? Yes. I hope I didn't lose. Did I lose people? I get kind of going, and I don't know. Hope I didn't lose you.
When you were talking about going from the cushion to life and bring it on,
yeah.
Could you just explain that? Because that's interesting. Like, I mean, bring it on, like just bring on the troubles and let me just accept them and deal with them, that type of thing. And
yeah, which was the purpose of the talk, but so I'll explain a little more. Generally speaking, so it's really good to see yourself in a problematic situation. Now, when I say problematic, that's because it's obvious. As the practitioner gets more and more better, for lack of a better word, advanced, then it happens even moment to moment because he or she sees this moment as problematic. Why? This moment is problematic in that it's seen incorrectly, ignorant. It's full of ignorance. So when I say take it on, it means really what I'm trying to say is we open ourselves up to the experience. And usually what we do in difficult situations is we don't open up, we protect. Let's say you're, I don't know, I can't think of an example, and there's so many. Maybe a hard time, I want to think of something a little more concrete, like something happening at work. You know, where maybe someone's performance is being questioned, so you can bring up a lot of, what's that called, you know, anxiety. A lot of fear. And so bring it on or, you know, opening up to it would be... So usually what we do is we try and solve... This is really interesting because I do this myself a lot. I try and solve it because I have all this background in Buddhist thinking. And I think, oh, it's my karma. Oh, it's... I must have done this a long time ago. Oh, you know, and it's all right, but it's not quite it for that moment, right? So opening up to it would be... is checking your motivation. The motivation for saying it's my karma, all those things, is really because you want to be free of it. And in this practice of thought transformation, you don't try and get free of it. You're with it. And you're with it because, and then you can use those ideas that it's my karmic imprints ripening, and I just got to, you know. But it's also, if you add to that, that this is actual, if I open up and experience it without defensiveness, then it actually has the side effect of enhancing those positive minds, in particular the awakening mind. But it doesn't have to just be that. The other stage could be, for example, patience. How are you going to be patient? For example, so we have to also be honest with who do we really want to be? You know, what values do we want to develop in ourselves? And I'm sure you know that some of these values are like things like patience, tolerance. Joy, ethics, for example. You can think about ethics, for example. So any one of those you can use. So ethics. So this person is really threatening you at your work, you know, with your work, your performance. Now, if you think of ethics, what would be the ethical thing to do, actually? The ethical thing would probably not get angry, not fight back, listen and evaluate and assess whether what he or she is saying is true or not, and making their mind happy. So how can you do that? You can only do that if you're very present and not in defense mode. Very open. Completely open. You know what's amazing? So when you're open, then even the criticism, the words he or she is saying, it's just like wind. I'll tell it, repeat it on, you know, let's just say this hypothetical situation. Let's say, so he's really grilling you, right? In actually, if you open up to it, what is really there? Just atoms. Nothing more. And it's not even really atoms, right? It's even, as we study reality, you know, you can't even find the atoms. But just for the sake, it's all neutral. It's just data. Isn't it? What he's saying, da-da-da, you. And then you're saying, I'm just going to open up to this. I'm not defensive. I really want to awaken in this moment. Whatever motivation you have. And you're scared and you're nervous and you're sweating and all that kind of stuff. I understand. But as you just say, I'm going to open up to it, I created this. Whatever works for you. But we have to have, we use those things, whatever works, I created this. And then you say, God, I've been studying at Padampa Center and I know that what's happening isn't really existing the way it appears. If you can just have that little bit. As you do it more and more, you will see that what's happening in front of you is like a dream. Because your embellishments begin to dissolve. The only reason we don't see this as for what it is because we embellish it, right? We that's what we're constantly putting the stuff on. You and I right now, I'm putting stuff on it. If I wasn't putting stuff on it, I would see that you're dependent arising from my mental imprints and my mental cognition, and being like a dream. Not same as a dream, but like a dream. Right? Does that help? So it's really about what you do with the cushion in the morning. I really recommend people, before you get up from your cushion, go, it's a difficult world, and I'm just going to use it. Rather than protect myself, I'm going to use it to, it's going to enhance my enlightenment. Other thing is, when you think about bodhisattvas, they're very heroic, aren't they? It's kind of like a heroic thing. That's why they're heroic. Not because they're anything else. It's because they think, I'm open to it. I got to do it for others. Like that. There's a lot of things you can do, but it's what resonates for you. Okay?
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Who's the dedicator?
Okay, we'll say dedication prayers on page 235 of the Gold Prayer Book. We'll just say the first two verses in English. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. And then on page 244, we have the long life prayers for His Holiness and for Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and we'll follow that with Green Tara's mantra 7 times. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.
So think about this. So we all came in today, this evening, we came in here. Where are those guys now? When you came in the room and I came in the room, we came in as solidly, a truly existing things. I'm really here. Where are you? Where is that guy? Where is that girl? And when I started talking a moment ago, where is that guy? Where is that girl? Are they still existing or not? So I'll see you later. Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you.